Ready to go? Excellent. So I am now continuing on from this morning's talk. In this morning's talk, I started to say how the limiters get stronger and more beautiful and more stable. And this is the natural path of developing, working with the limiters. Of those two, the stability and the power of the limiters, it's always the stability which is the most important. That light in the mind just remains there and doesn't move. Because as long as it's stable, the energy will go into that light by itself. It does get brighter by its very nature, and it begets more blissful by its nature. And of course, it does take a lot of letting go not to interfere with something which is so powerful and so joyful. But eventually, the joy gets extremely strong, and the power gets very intense, and it becomes an automatic process. It just draws you deeper and deeper in. Now, already one person mentioned in their interviews about the tunnel phenomena, just being drawn into something. And that is so common with the limiters. If the limiter, you perceive it like a tunnel drawing you in, just please, just let it happen. Be a passenger. You never go crazy. You only get into these deep meditations called the jhanas, which are absolutely wonderful and very useful, and where you get huge amounts of insight. They're always very positive. So what happens is that either you fall into the limiter or experience yourself dissolving into the limiter, uniting in that limiter, becoming at one with that limiter, or just the limiter enveloping you. And at that time, the main perception does change automatically. You don't choose what to do. If you make any choice, the whole experience falls apart. This is an automatic process. You merge into that limiter, and instead of perceiving a light, what you're now perceiving is just the bliss of this experience. When a person emerges from the jhana, and you ask them, what did you experience? And for a while they're really quite shocked. They're not really quite clear what had happened, and it was something huge and magnificent, and they're so happy and blissed out. They don't really care that much to describe it, but with pressure on them, you know, you ask them, they usually find this out for themselves, but if I want to find out quickly, they usually call it incredible bliss, which is the main object which you are mindful of in those jhanas. So again, as I mentioned earlier, with the simile which I drew from the Samanyapada Sutta, King Ajata Sattu going to see the Buddha for the first time in a chariot as far as a chariot could go, getting off the chariot, walking in his slippers as far as that could go, then taking off his slippers to go into the hall. Each one of these are vehicles which can take you so far. And so you may use a vehicle of, say, a Buddha Anusati or something, or to get you to the breath, and then from the breath that will carry you to the limiters. You let go of the breath to be with the limiter, and the limiters take you just to the doorway of the jhanas, and you actually literally step off the limiter and into the bliss. And that becomes your object of awareness. So in the first jhana, there's many jhanas, but the first jhana is that is where the object of your mind is the piti sukha, which is born of viveka. And this word viveka, seclusion, you've all heard of the two types of seclusion, kaya viveka and chitta viveka. Kaya viveka is the seclusion of the body, where you go into your kuti and shut the door, where you become physically secluded from the busyness of the world, where you turn off your iPhones and become physically secluded from the busyness of the world again, and when you stop, this is a physical seclusion. And then we also have the citta viveka, but it's actually more than that. The viveka, the real kaya viveka, is a further seclusion from your own body. So in other words, your mind is not interested in the busyness of having a body. Just like you can turn off your iPhone, you don't get any emails, SMSs, whatever else you have on that machine. You almost turn the switch in the mind so you don't receive any signals, any SMSs or emails from your sight, from your hearing, from your smell, from your taste, from your touch. And it is that viveka which causes the bliss. When you see in the Pali, vivicehi kamehi, vivicha akusalehi damehi, that is the beginning of the standard description of the jhanas. Vivicha, as you should all know enough Pali, means that it's the path, that's what I call it the gerund. It depends on who taught you Pali grammar. But it means like having wakened, having separated from. And the word karma, kelong ama, often is described as the sensory pleasures, referring to the five senses, not the sixth sense. That to me does not make sense. That's karma sukha. Whereas the word karma by itself usually refers to the world of the five senses, like karma loka. You know, the world in which we animals and lower deva beings live and abide, in karma loka. The world of five senses. And so vivicehi kamehi means separated completely from those five senses. So that is one of the reasons why in the jhanas, and this is borne out by experience, in the jhanas, in the first jhana, you cannot hear. You cannot see, smell, taste, or have physical touch. Even though the suttas do say that the sound is a thorn to the first jhana, which actually means that if your first jhana is not strong, that sometimes a big shout or a bang can sometimes draw you out. Just like the alarm clock, the sound of an alarm clock, can draw you out of a sleep. It is the sound which penetrates deep into the mind and can take you out of a very weak first jhana. But even a middle strength, or especially high strength first jhanas, you won't be able to hear sounds at all. I love telling anecdotes, modern anecdotes. Unfortunately, I cannot tell many anecdotes about myself because, again, that is making a claim and I get into big trouble when I try to do things like that. So I like telling other anecdotes about close disciples. And this was one gentleman, I did write about this in my book, called Greg. And he was a meditator, upasaka, not a monk. And he would come to our temple, he was really interested in Buddhism, and he would meditate regularly. But he was always enjoying his sensory pleasures as well. He was watching the TV one Sunday afternoon when he was bored. There was nothing which interested him on the TV. So he told his wife that he was going to go to his room and do some meditation, usually for about 45 minutes. When an hour and a half had gone past or something like that, his wife decided to find out what he was doing. He hadn't come out of his room. So she went into the bedroom and saw him still meditating there, perfectly still. Unfortunately, it was too still, because she couldn't see his chest rising and falling. He was not breathing. And so she got very scared and called the emergency number. I don't know what the emergency number in Sri Lanka is. Is it 999 like England? Well, it doesn't matter because we don't need it here. But in Australia it's 000. In England it's 999. I think in USA 911. Oh, what? Yeah. Something like that anyway. She called the emergency number. Within 5 minutes, an ambulance came screeching to the door with the sirens wailing. And the men, the medics, they rushed into the bedroom and they saw he wasn't breathing. They felt his pulse. There was no pulse. And these are trained medical personnel. So they immediately put him into the stretcher, into the back of the ambulance, with his wife in attendance, really going so crazy, so frightened, her husband was dead. And there, I'm not sure what other machines they put on him to in the ambulance, but it wasn't that far to the hospital. When they got to the hospital, immediately into the emergency room, where they have the latest equipment. And they put what they call ECG on his heart. And the ECG was flat. A flat line. Which means the heart was not pumping at all. And then they put an EEG on his head. Which manages to pick up the brain waves. That too had flat lines. He was clinically dead. Now. And this was actually from his wife. It was really a shame that there was no scientist there to record everything and write it all down. But this actually is what happened. So, he was dead there. And what saved him from being put into the morgue straight away, and this is fascinating because it is an agreement with a statement which you find in the suttas. And it's one of the first times I've seen this statement by the Buddha. Actually, it was by, I think, Visakha. Well, the Buddha is in the either Mahavedala or Chulavedala Sutta. And there the Buddha says the difference between deep meditation and being dead is that your body is still warm. And that actually was what the doctor on duty that afternoon noticed. The only difference between a normal dead body and this gentleman was he hadn't lost his body temperature at all. It was still warm. And that was so strange that the doctor asked, how did this happen? And when his wife said he had been meditating, the doctor thought that this may not be real death, but it may be a deep meditative experience. Because that doctor, his parents had migrated from India, and he had grown up hearing about yogis who could suspend all of their life functions and become so incredibly still and come out sometimes days later. And he thought, maybe this is such a case. And of course it was. But, trying to revive him, the doctor on duty in the emergency room put what they call defibrillators on his chest. These are pads through which they pass quite an intense electric current, which makes the body jerk. And it is a very violent procedure, if you've ever seen it. Many times he put these electric pads on this gentleman's, on Greg's chest to try and jerk his heart into operation. Many, many times this happened, but still the heart was flat-lined. Nothing was happening. And I'm not quite sure he was about to give up because I wasn't given this information, but many, many times tried to use defibrillators to get his heart started. And Greg told me that it was just his meditation time to come out. So he just came out of his meditation and opened his eyes. And at that point, beep, 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 the ECG registered a normal heartbeat, and the EEG, measuring the brain function, started to function properly. It had been flatlined for quite a long time, I don't know how long, and the defibrillators didn't work. But once he came out of his meditation, he told me he opened his eyes and he bent up and said, "What am I doing in here? I was in my bedroom. What's happened?" And that's when he found out the story. His wife was very relieved that he was alive. And he said the whole experience was just the most bliss that he'd ever experienced in his life. It was a wonderful experience. And the doctor checked him up. Everything was perfectly normal. So the doctor did not even have him stay overnight in hospital for observation. He just let him go and he walked home with his wife. And he said the only unpleasant part of the whole experience was the scolding he received from his wife, who was very angry at him. "Don't you ever do that again. Never again. I thought you were dead. I was worried sick. You enjoyed yourself, but please think about me next time." That was very unpleasant, he said. But the important part of that little anecdote was that during that whole experience, he could not feel these medics lifting his body up and putting him into the stretcher, take him into the ambulance. He couldn't even feel these violent electric shocks on his body. He could not hear the na-da-da-da-da-da of the sirens rushing through every red light. He could neither hear nor feel during that whole time. Yet, he was fully aware, more mindful than he'd ever been before, but of deep, wonderful bliss. Now that's an anecdote from someone who did not know the Pali expressions for a jhana of what actually happens to you. You are just so beautifully peaceful. Anecdote number two. This was a monk who I met many years ago who told me, and as soon as I met this monk in a temple called Wat Bawan in Bangkok, as soon as I went past him and met him for the first time, you could feel this monk had very strong power, a very strong monk. So the first opportunity I went to chat with him, and he told me his story. As a young man in Indonesia, in Java, he always wanted to be a hermit. So he went off into the jungles of Java when there were still many places which were uninhabited, just like Thailand and hopefully never Sri Lanka. Population pressure just invades the jungles and they all get into housing estates, unfortunately. But anyway, he went through a jungle, sat down, and he described his meditation. Again, he had no knowledge of the suttas, no understanding of what jhana really is, but this was his explanation. He said he was sitting there in the jungle quietly, and he was really, really peaceful. And he said a star appeared in his mind. And what he said, he married the star. He used a strange expression in English, like a boy and girl getting married. But that's what he said. He married the star. Now this is your perceptions and the way we describe these things. This is typical of jhanas. You can even say that yourself. You marry the nimitta. You go right inside it. Become one with it. And that's how he described it. And then he said he was in his deep meditation for such a long time, he didn't know how long. He didn't have a watch. He didn't have a calendar. He did not have an iPhone. He didn't have any duties whatsoever. He was running away from the world. So he came out from meditation and he noticed the jungle around him was different than when he went in. It had changed. And he went to the local village and asked, and they were quite surprised because there had been a very fierce rainstorm, and that area of the jungle had flooded, which explains the, you know, the marks on the trees and the branches which were there when he sat down to begin, but which weren't there afterwards. And he worked out that he had been submerged underwater for several days. He could not feel the water. He did not need to breathe, so he didn't die. He was perfectly happy being an underwater yogi for so many days. Perfectly still, perfectly happy, perfectly mindful, but not of what was going on outside of his body. That is typical of a deep jhana. And just to inspire you, now because you're monks and nuns, psychic powers. When I hear or see monks with psychic powers, I keep them very quiet. I will never tell you of any psychic powers which I have. And there's a good reason for that. And the reason I didn't say anything about this monk's powers was because he was still alive. He's dead now, so it means that it cannot really affect him. His name was Sudamo. Not a very well-known monk. Like many really good monks, you don't know them. They don't go exhibiting. They don't go flying around Colombo to try and get donations for their temple. They just are so simple. You don't know who they are. But this monk, he was teaching a meditation class for lay people in Wat Pa Wan. And one of those lay people was a disciple of mine, and also a princess. She was a grandchild of one of the kings of Thailand. I knew her really well, and not the person who would try and deceive me. Keeping five precepts, she told me what happened to her. She was very distressed, because she was meditating in a group with this monk leading the meditation, and she felt that there's something not quite right. So she opened her eyes. And when she opened her eyes, she swears to me, says, absolutely true, I don't lie to you. I saw rays of light coming out of this monk's eyes, going into one of the meditators. Like laser eyes going into somebody. The person who told me that was far from being crazy. And the monk who did that was a very powerful monk. So, those things do exist in this world. The monks, or the nuns, who knows, with laser eyes, sap. So, it gives an example, I say this, that you don't feel the body, you can't hear sound in these jhanas. And the bliss, the experience of that jhana, the piti sukha, is precisely because you can't feel those things. The five senses have gone, disappeared. That is why it is so blissful. And when people ask, well, what do you do these things for? Just go into jhanas. It was just for fun, you get attached and that's all. I said, no. When you have an experience like that, to be so far away from the body, and it's so blissful, you know, you usually ask yourself afterwards, why? Where did that pleasure come from? And it doesn't take a rocket scientist or a Stephen Hawking to realize the reason why that was blissful was because so much suffering has disappeared. When suffering vanishes, it's usually a lot of bliss afterwards. If you've had a terrible, terrible headache, and you get some magic medicine, and the headache goes, oh, that's so nice to be free of that awful pain. If you really want to go to the toilet, and Ajahn Brahm's talk is going on and on and on and on, you don't want to leave, oh, that's just such suffering. But when you go to the toilet, oh, that feels so good. Much of happiness, piti sukha, is an end of some suffering. A disappearance of dukkha means sukha, happiness. So this is a huge amount of dukkha has disappeared, which is why the first jhana is so incredibly blissful. The body is a bunch of dukkha. The five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, is dukkha. Even the happy feelings of the body are dukkha. Because when it all goes, it's just incredible sukha. Which is one of the reasons why, even in the first jhana, I don't know how you cannot get the insight. The body is so much suffering, and so things like what you really enjoy doing in life, seeing football matches, or cricket, or sex, or movies, or whatever it is in the world of five senses which you enjoy, now, hearing Beethoven's Fifth, looking at a beautiful sunset, going and seeing the Great Wall of China or Niagara Falls, whatever you really feel is one of the greatest pleasures which you can get in the world of the five senses. The sort of things which people pay millions of dollars to try and see. That's all, please excuse me, shit. It's suffering, it's not worth anything when you've got something else to compare it with. Which is the bliss of a first jhana. Which is one of the reasons why you get into those first jhanas and afterwards you're not interested anymore in this world of the five senses. For a while. Temporary, but you can see its power until that insight really, really changes your perceptions once and for all. That's the first jhana. Now, in that first jhana, already trying to explain that there's no perception of sound or no perception of the body, there's also the other thing which the Buddha said was the vitakka vichara. And that vitakka vichara has caused a lot of problems for many meditators because they assume that vitakka vichara means, even it's translated like this in many English, thinking and pondering. And my goodness, you should all have enough experience of meditation already to know that thinking is very gross and coarse and very disturbing. And that even early on in meditation, thinking and pondering should disappear. Let alone, how can it be present in such a refined state of mind called a first jhana? And indeed, it is not present. Words have different meanings in different contexts. You know, I already mentioned the word body. If it's in a doctor's surgery, the body means your physical body. If you're in a court of law, it means a body of evidence. If you're in an army camp, it's a body of soldiers. Words have different meanings in the different contexts. And the vitakka vichara, and here I did read the Visuddhimagga and totally agree with the Visuddhimagga. The vitakka vichara does not mean thinking in the context of jhana. What it does mean, and this is, you know, not just from the suttas, from personal experience, you can see in that first jhana it's different than the other jhanas because you have the object of meditation, this is the bliss, just like the object may be your breath or the nimittas, that is what the mindfulness knows. However, the bliss is not stable. And the best word in English I could find to describe it wobbles. If you know the word wobble in English, you know, it just shakes a bit. It's not stable. And the reason is that there is still a little bit of action being done by the mind. A little bit, not 100% letting go yet. 99.9%, but the person is literally grasping, holding that bliss. A little bit of afraid it might go. Like most things we do in life, when we're having a good time, we attach to it too hard. So the tiny attaching to that bliss, that is the vichara. It's holding on to it. And because of that, it creates instability It is as if your mind just moves away, you know, from that bliss. But it's so strong, it attracts you straight back in. That is the vitakka. You don't come out of any jhanas. You are so close to that bliss, it's just a wobble. It doesn't disappear. It's a wobble of the first jhana. Simply because you haven't 100% let go. A little bit of attaching to the bliss of that jhana. What happens next? I should go more on the first jhana. I've often wondered about the first jhana and people's different experiences of it, because it seems to be that people describe the first jhana in different ways. I always use the Buddha's description as the base, because you can't go past the Buddha. And those people have experienced these states many, many times. Their faith and respect for the Lord Buddha increases enormously. Not just the fact that, you know, that you can recognize those experiences, but the Buddha's ability to describe them. Because sometimes if you come out of those experiences, it's just so difficult to put words to them. Because they're totally different than any experience you have in this world outside. I won't say in the real world, because when so many lay people, they say, well, when we get back to the real world after getting jhana, then what should we do? That I don't call the real world. The real world is in jhana. Their world is the fake world. So when people say real world, they say, no, your world is not the real world. You live in the fake world. So, because all of the language comes from the fake world, where, you know, we live most of the time, because of that, it's so difficult to describe this. Now, have you ever had, like, a pain or a sickness, and you go to the doctor, and the doctor said, describe it. And how difficult, well, it hurts. Yeah, I know it hurts, but describe it. There's so many different types of pain. Give me more information so I can diagnose what the problem is. And I remember this person, and I know it's not the place for jokes. I was going to tell a joke, but I'll maybe put that aside. When a person has a sickness, it's too difficult to describe because we don't have much language. And imagine how more difficult it is for a person who has an experience of a jhana. The language is just so difficult. But if you've been there many times, you can recognize when people describe these states of jhana. So I was always fascinated to investigate people of other traditions who said they had jhanas. In particular, the Christian tradition in the Middle Ages. Because there was a couple of characters, St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, were the most impressive of those people, and they seem to have the jhanas. This lady Teresa of Avila would levitate in front of people, and often the nuns, you know, who were, you know, around her, grabbed hold of her legs and pulled her back to earth, literally, so she didn't fly into the roof of the chapel or cathedral wherever she was. And many people saw that. So there were some psychic powers going on with these people. And I wondered, and they must be based on jhana, what exactly were they doing? So I read, actually, what their experience was. And they based their practice on surrender to a divine being. They surrendered their whole will to their God, or their idea of a God. And when I heard that, I understood, well, that, I can understand how that would lead to a jhana. They let go. They didn't do anything. And, of course, their inspiration gave them enormous happiness. That joy and letting go, even though they had no much instructions, I can see how that can lead to a first jhana. And I can also understand how they describe the experience of the first jhana. which they always said was union with the divine, union with God. Why? Number one, the union, the ekagata, gone to one peak of experience. As you all know, ekagata does not mean one-pointedness. There is two G's there. It's ekagata. Aga means peak or summit. So, knowing a little bit of Pali, you see, now it's the same word for any Westerner, Agra, the Sanskrit word for Agra. Agra, the peak city of India during the Mughal empires. Agra, you know, where the Taj Mahal is and the Red Fort. It means the peak, the capital. It's not just one pointedness of mind, one summit of the mind. A single summit perception. So, huge oneness, union. Why do they say with God? Because that bliss you experience in a jhana, if you were a Christian, there's nothing higher than that. Wow, that's incredible. That's just so powerful bliss. And that's the name they would call it. God. Sometimes that people experience that and they come out without the knowledge of the Buddhist terminology, say, the most incredible love. And that also intrigues me, how bliss and the purest of love always seem to be describing the same thing. And these are just words, but they're interesting. But also I notice that many monks and nuns get at least the first jhana. And if they were Christians, they would be called saints. Because if you've had union with God and come out afterwards, that's automatic qualifications to be a saint. So, Metta-vihāri would be Saint Metta-vihāri. And we'd have schools named after him, and college. Saint Metta-vihāri College, Saint Metta-vihāri Hospital. But it's really, we're not into that religion, so unfortunately, that you can't claim to be a saint because you have to be a Christian first of all. But nevertheless, some of them had similar experiences. And you can understand why. Because they surrendered. Surrender. Letting go. Taking your hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. Letting go of control. Total surrender to the process. Huge limiters coming up. Surrendering to the jitta, to the mind. Letting go. Disappearing. Because that's why they called it union with God. Because they say, I can't find myself there. Their perception of a being themselves totally disappeared. It is a experience, not full experience, but no, pretty close to anatta. You're not there anymore. Everything which you recognize yourself as is taken away, is vanished. You're not recognizable as the being you're used to in that first jhana. There is, I say, a little bit of will left, but it's not the same will you have normally. It is automatic, the vitakka vichara, the wobble. But all the other things which you recognize of yourself, being able to see and feel and even know the past and the future, and often your past defines you, who you are. I'm English because I was born in England, whatever that means, that's in the past, many years in the past. I'm a male, but there's no body in jhana, so you're not a male, you're not a female, you're nothing. You're not gay, you're not lesbian, you're nothing. All that's disappeared totally. So many of your reference points, which describe and which you assume to be yourself, is gone. Which is why they say, St. Teresa of Avila, I've disappeared. I just merged with God. But what Buddhists are doing, totally lost your sense of self, and you've merged with bliss. Because what happens next? You stay there long enough. Obviously, Sir Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross never stayed long enough in their jhana. You stayed a bit longer. Then because things are very still, they disappear. you don't decide to move from the first jhana to the second jhana. It just happens because you are still. Something vanishes. And the first thing which vanishes is vitakka. The mind moving on to the object. You let go a bit, you relax more, you become a bit more peaceful. And after many, many experiences of this, you can actually see it happening. You see it happening, you can't really think about it at the time, you can't take notes, but afterwards you can recall the experience and see what happens. That your mind is still holding on to the bliss. But so lightly now, it doesn't disturb that bliss. So the mind doesn't move away. You don't need to move back again. But it's still holding on there. And that explained to me what Sariputta said as the fifth jhana between the first and the second, the 1.5 jhana, which you find in some of the suttas there. I can't remember the numbers now. It's avitakka savichara. No vitakka in the jhana, but with avichara. You're still holding on, but it's not hard enough, it's not disturbing enough, you don't move away. You're perfectly still. To me, I would always say that really belongs to the second jhana, because there's no vitakka. But Sariputta, much wiser, said, no, that's right in between the first and second jhana. And of course, the avichara just totally disappears. You're not holding the object anymore. And the reason is because of confidence. That last little bit of fear which gives rise to control. All control comes from fear. All sort of doing comes because you're afraid, what will happen to me if I don't do something? I have to make sure I do this meditation. Who knows what might happen? So when the last bit of fear vanishes, you have real confidence. You don't need to hold on to anything anymore. Just like a baby. I've seen this when I've been in shopping centres in Australia. Doing some blessing. I had to be very, very careful. New monks also be careful. When people, your daikas, invite you to some blessing ceremony. Because there was a friend of a friend once invited me into a shopping centre to bless their new shop. Just as a favour for them. They'd help me so that I can do some blessing for you, some pyrrhic chanting to give you good luck. But sometimes I'm really too busy, and because of my busyness I become negligent. And my negligence was not asking what type of shop it was. It was a lottery shop. Just saying lottery tickets. But when I found out, it was too late. So I did the blessing, the pyrrhic chanting and pyrrhic water, the whole thing. And it's only about a year later, I thought, oh my goodness, what have I done? Because somebody showed me an article in the newspaper. The luckiest shop in the whole of Australia. More people won the lottery in that shop than any other shop. And I thought, my goodness, what have I done? So be careful if people invite you to some blessing or whatever. Sometimes you don't know what you're doing, you get in big trouble afterwards. So, anyway, I didn't get into trouble because I never let people know what I was doing. So, when you go in the shopping centre, often I've seen mothers carrying their babies under one arm and pushing a shopping trolley in the other arm. And really busy, lots and lots of people. And those babies are fast asleep. They are so confident that their mother won't drop them. They can go fast asleep. If somebody carried me, they'd have to be very strong. If they carried me in a shopping centre, I'd be so terrified that one bump and I'd fall on the floor. I would never ever be able to go to sleep. But babies can, because they have that degree of trust and confidence. They don't have any fear at all. They know their mother's going to protect them. Let them go fast asleep in a busy place. Now, that's just like the second jhana. You got so confident that you let go of the vichara. That vanishes. And with that, you are finally perfectly still. It's from Sampasadanam that the mind becomes totally still, absolute confidence, so the mind does not move. In the first jhana, there is still residual movement, the wobble. In the second jhana, it's more still than you can ever imagine. Nothing moves. That's one of the reasons when people started calling samadhi concentration, it never really made sense. Stillness makes sense because this is the peak of stillness. In the second jhana, it is called samadhija piti sukha, the bliss born of stillness, where nothing moves and it can't move. And that's just an incredible experience for those people who enjoy peace. You know, you go back to your room with peace from all these talks and all this eating and all these lay people giving you food. Peace. You go into a jungle, so peaceful, away from all other people. But then you go into still the sound of crickets and other stuff going on. And then you go into the mind, you go into the meditation. It's so peaceful. You know, when you can't feel your body, the body's just this big noise, always irritating you, scratching, coughing, aching. And then you go into the mind and it's really peaceful and you get so joyful when you get into a second jhana because that is real peace. Everything else is just so noisy. Here, total peace. And that's the joy of such peace. Born of samadhi, caused by confidence. Lack of any fear, lack of any control. And I say that that is a powerful experience because in there, your will has vanished. It's gone. It's usual experience, you don't exert your will, but it's always there for you. Whenever you want to choose, right now you can get up and go, no one will stop you. Right now you can scratch your nose if you want to, it's your choice. Even though you decide not to. But in the second jhana, the choice to do or not to do is not there. It's totally vanished. Like nothing you've experienced before, your will is gone. So peaceful. And that's why it is incredibly joyful. Now, there is a problem with getting into the first or second jhana. That is, once you're in, you can't come out. Because there's no will left. You can't say to yourself, oh, time to come out. That's impossible to do. Because there's no buttons to press anymore. And now I tell you another story, which is one of my favorites, of a Theravada monk from Vietnam. I won't tell you his name, and I didn't ask his name, because if I knew his name, someone will soon enough ask me, and then the poor monk will get sort of bombarded with invitations and people. That's what happens when people do strange, weird things. They get famous, and it destroys them, like Devadatta. So this person, this monk, he was teaching a meditation retreat somewhere in Australia. Not in my monastery, over on the east coast of Australia. I don't want to say where. And on the 9-day retreats for lay people, it usually begins, you know, with everybody checking in, finding their rooms, being told the basic schedule, and usually sometimes around maybe 7:30, a half an hour meditation, followed by a talk by the teacher, this monk, this Vietnamese monk. So everybody gathered in the meditation hall at 7:30, including the Vietnamese monk, and started meditating. When it came to 8 o'clock, the monk was still meditating. They were waiting for him to come out to begin the Dhamma Desana, the Bana. He never came out. When it got to 9 o'clock, he still hadn't come out of his meditation. So being Upasakas and Upasikas, especially Australian ones, they all left the hall and went to bed. When they got up in the morning and went to the hall for the morning meditation and doing some chanting, he was still sitting there. He hadn't moved all night. When it came to the breakfast, he was still sitting there. They all went for breakfast. When they came back from breakfast, he was still sitting there. He sat there for 8 days, not moving, not drinking, not going to the toilet, not giving any talk at all to anybody, just sitting as still as a Buddha statue, not moving. After 8 days, he came out from his meditation, and the lay people were there, and apparently what he said was, "I apologize, I'm sorry. I haven't given you any talks or instructions or interviews or nothing. I'm terribly sorry. I was just in my meditation, blissing out, not knowing how long the time had gone." He was among more than the 7 days, which it says in the suttas. He was 8 days, sitting there, not moving, not drinking, not having any water, not going to the toilet, perfectly still, for 8 days. And all the lay people there, I'm sure if I was there, I would have said the same. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. How inspiring it is to see that in this day and age, such things can still happen, like we saw in the time of the Buddha. Still monks can get into those deep meditations so they don't need to eat or drink or go to the toilet. Perfectly still. So he said, don't worry about not giving the talks. That was inspiring. But I would be inspired too, but also I would teach that monk afterwards, that is not the way to do jhanas. Because what you have to do, if you start getting these jhanas, is to do an adhisthana before you enter, usually at the beginning of the meditation. You usually know your meditation is good, and there's a good likelihood you might get into a jhana. So you do adhisthana. I will come out at 8 p.m. so I can talk to the lay people. And he forgot to do that. That's why he was in that for 8 days. And those adhisthanas are incredibly effective. You play around with these just to see what you can do. So you're going to get into a jhana. You know that you're on that sort of path. And you tell yourself, I will come out at 23 minutes past 2. Make it interesting. Don't say 2 o'clock or 2:30. Make it interesting, a challenge to the mind. 23 minutes past 2. A strange number. Then you go into your meditation, go into a jhana. And what happens is, you don't know why, because you're totally still, but the jhana just ends. You go through the jhanas backwards, and you come out, you open your eyes really happy, and you look at your clock, 23 minutes past 2. Exactly. I don't know how that works, but your mind has its own clock, and it's accurate, it's not run on battery, so it doesn't go slow or fast or stop. Totally accurate. It doesn't run on Sri Lankan time. Is accurate. And so that is how you should practice if you start getting into the jhanas. Because otherwise, sometimes it's not that you have to go to a talk, but sometimes people get worried about you. You're sitting there perfectly still and you're not doing your other responsibilities. So set the time. And it works perfectly. And of course, after the second jhana, the beautiful piti sukha of the stillness, not moving. Again, understand that when things are still, after a while, something vanishes. I believe I did tell the story of when I was a young man go to the Zen monastery, watching the white wall in the Zendo, the Zen meditation hall, with my eyes open, my mind was still, and the wall vanished. It disappeared. It wasn't there anymore. Just the nature, not just of the brain, of the mind. When things are still and they don't move, they disappear, they vanish. And this explains the process of the next jhanas. You're so still, something vanishes. And what vanishes is the piti. And sukha without piti is far more blissful. Now, people say, well, what is the piti? And what is the sukha? Define it. And it's so difficult to explain. Again, the words are not good enough because in my experience, piti, sukha always are together. They're like twins, inseparable in most parts of life. Yeah, you may be focusing on one aspect, but piti, sukha seem to always go together. And they only separate when second jhana starts to fade into the third jhana. And it's only if you've had experience of third jhana do you really understand what this sukha is. Far more refined than the gross form of happiness which we call piti. But it doesn't really need a label. Just leave it on the Pali, piti and sukha. And of course, the sukha of the third jhana is again so delightful. But you're so still, eventually that fades away. Till you get into this fourth jhana. Perfect equanimity, so still. And even though sukha has supposed to have disappeared, it's still so blissful. That's why the idea of sukha is a bit confusing for many people. The ordinary form of sukha which you know has gone, and the sukha which is left is called upeka sukha. It's all sukha all the way through. Happiness, the joy, the happiness of ordinary happiness disappearing. So every one of these stages is so beautiful. It is like if you've ever gone walking in the mountains. You go to one peak and you think that's the highest. And then you look over and there's another peak which is higher. And you go to that and you think there can't be anything higher than this. But there is. You go to the next one. And that is like the journey of jhanas. If you ever achieve a first jhana, you think sometimes this is the ultimate. You can't get more blissful than this. Which is why some people call it God. Which is why some people think experience of first jhana, this must be enlightenment. Some people actually think that. They get confused. They don't know the Buddha's teachings very well. But then you get to another stage, much more peaceful, more beautiful, the second jhana. And my experience was, how many more of these are there? Yeah, you know, you see the Buddha's teachings. It's only supposed to be two more, but now this seems to be the highest. Is there anything higher? And that's the experience. Bliss upon bliss upon bliss, and not wondering where this will all end. It's an amazing journey, joyful, but giving you so much understanding and insight into the nature of the mind, into the nature of the will, into the nature of happiness itself. Incredible insights, not based on thinking, not based on logic, not based on inferring, but based on raw experience, which actually turns you upside down. You can never see the world in the same way afterwards. So that's why they have power. But those are a little descriptions of the four jhanas, how they work. Very quickly, based on the fourth jhana, then the immaterial attainments happen, the arupas. And I cannot see, I cannot comprehend how a person can even understand the immaterial attainments unless they have the experience of a fourth jhana. To me, the immaterial attainments are a special case of the fourth jhana. They come in the realm of a fourth jhana, totally still. Because again, when you're totally still, things must vanish. The only thing left to vanish is the mind itself, the awareness. the knower, the manavijnana, that vanishes slowly. The first arupa is the state called infinite space, is usually which the term which they use. I don't like that at all, that terminology. I like undefined space. Ananta. Anta is an edge. It's a boundary which defines things. Sri Lanka is defined by its boundary, by its borders. You know, Switzerland, you know where Switzerland's got a border. It's got an end to it, an anta. And I prefer like undefined space. And I make a simile which most people can understand, because this is the point of being a teacher. You have these incredible experiences. You want to take them and put them in a form where people who've never had that experience get some idea of what it means. Simple things like present moment awareness. And just about everybody understands what that means. But when you are really in the present, really here, really now, it's like there is no time. If you really go in the present moment when you're meditating, and meditation half an hour can go past, then it's like nothing. It's like one moment. It's no time, and at the same time, infinite time. It's when in the present moment, both those two, it's undefined time, unbounded time in the present moment. So when you go into the center of things, it starts to disappear. It loses its meaning. So I understand the best description of the first arupa is where the whole concept of space loses all meaning. It disappears. Basically, the mind does not comprehend or respond to any idea of space. And the next one is where infinite consciousness means that consciousness loses its meaning. Undefined, not bounded. It doesn't mean infinite consciousness, because that is a dangerous word. When people say infinite consciousness, then they start thinking of God, cosmic consciousness, the overlord, and all sorts of ridiculous stuff like that. It's like consciousness is disappearing. And what happens when consciousness disappears? There's nothing. So what happens here is that you are perceiving nothing. How can you do that? I mean, real nothing. Not nothing as something, as a thing, but nothing as nothing. Basically, your consciousness is vanishing. And when the object of consciousness disappears like nothing, the consciousness starts to disappear. The object disappears first, and the knower starts to disappear next. So after you're seeing nothing, experiencing nothing, really nothing, of course, another aspect of the consciousness turns off. You're not perceiving anymore. But you're perceiving, you're not perceiving anymore. This weird state of the neither perception nor non-perception. And of course, once that is there for a little while, the whole mind turns off. Click, it's neroded. The knower, the mind, awareness has stopped. That is called stillness. Nothing is left, not even the knowing. Little by little, things disappear. Viraga, fading away. Forgetting to jhana, your body fades away. As you go through the jhanas, the will fades, your old whole ideas of pity and sukha fade, and then the object of your mind fades, and with it, your mind fades, until it stops in erodus. How long you stay in there? How long you determine to stay in there? And then obviously you come out again. But again, you come out totally different. Because you've experienced stuff. You've seen animals emerge from the jungle, so rare Most people don't ever know they exist. You've experienced them. And you will change forever. Great insights have to arise. Okay, so there we go. That's a little talk on jhanas. You may not understand it. You may disagree with it. But one day it will happen. As it happens to all meditators who follow the path. Woo, you've got something wonderful to look forward to. The time, not the time of your life, the time of your many lives. Enjoy. Thank you.